And hello again. This is maybe the fourth time I've been here, I'm not quite sure. I don't know what I keep doing, but Don keeps inviting me back, and I'm genuinely very grateful for that. It's a privilege, it's something I don't take for granted, so it's really, really good to be here. You'll see on the notice sheet that the theme, the topic that I've been asked to preach on is on forgiveness, on forgiving and being forgiven. You may or may not remember that the last time I was here, which maybe a year or more ago, I can't remember, I actually preached on the Lord's Prayer and on forgiveness. So for a brief moment, I was tempted just to preach the same sermon again and see if anyone noticed. And maybe give an Easter egg to anyone that did. And I suspect I'd keep all the Easter eggs to me. No. So I am going to develop the theme of forgiveness further, but in a slightly different way this morning. And just to warn you now, to prepare yourselves, you're going to be doing some of the work. This is not the chance to just sit back and fall asleep and go to your happy place. I am going to make you do some work at some point. So I'll just give you a chance to think about that. We're going to come to the Bible reading in a little while, and it will appear on the screen when we do. I'm going to say one or two things first before we do the Bible reading. And as Donna said, I work for the Anglican Church in Scotland now, and one of the things Anglicans are good at is reading out loud. So we're going to read it out loud together. We're going to read the passage together. And again, there's a reason for doing that. I wanted to think this morning about, if you like, the complexity of forgiveness. Because forgiveness is such an easy thing to say, but it's a very, very difficult thing to do. I remember a friend of mine telling me when his son was born, he realized that not only would he die for him, he would kill for him. And if anyone hurt him, he would kill that person. And I think most parents understand that emotion. And then you hear of circumstances, and I think back to it's a long time ago now, but the IRA attack in Enniskillen, and the father of one of the people who was killed there who forgave the people, and you just think the profoundness of that forgiveness, that's not easy. Forgiveness is not just let it go, you know. The frozen is not our theology of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a complex, difficult thing, and yet it is something that we are called to do because we are forgiven. In fact, it's rather scary when Jesus says, forgive not only as the Lord forgave you, but if you do not forgive, the Lord will not forgive you. It's rather a profound challenge. So we're going to think a little bit about the complexity of forgiveness, and not only how we might forgive others, but how we might be those who help others to forgive. Because living with bitterness, living with resentment, living with a lack of forgiveness, while understandable, is poisonous and detrimental to ourselves. We're the ones that suffer. It's a bit of a cliche, and you may have heard it, that living without forgiveness is like drinking poison and hoping that someone else dies. It's we are the ones that suffer. So how can we not only live lives of forgiveness, but help others to get beyond bitterness, hurt, pain, to live at peace? And this is a profound challenge, but a profound call to us as Christians. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. So there's something about being a child of God that's about being a peacemaker. And there's something about being a peacemaker that makes you a child of God. The two seem to go together. Proverbs is wonderful. It's full of really practical, observed, real-life wisdom. And I love, there's a verse at the end of Proverbs. Well, Proverbs 26:17 says this, like one who grabs a stray dog by the ears is someone who rushes into a quarrel not their own. And that's a fantastic image of the, if you like, the difficulty of peacemaking. I just love the visual image. Just imagine yourself, I mean, don't ask how you got there, but imagine you've got a stray dog and you're holding it by the ears. Because you know there's no easy way out of that set of circumstances. It's like, right, what do we do now? So peacemaking, being agents for forgiveness, being those who seek to bring forgiveness into the lives of others is no light calling. It's difficult. It's not an easy thing. Any kids fight in the playground, if any other child decided to try and break it up, usually ended up getting beaten up by the kids that were having the fight in the first place. Peacemaking can be seen as somehow standing on the moral high ground and can cause resentment. Who do you think you are? Do you think you're better than us? So it's difficult, and yet we are called to be peacemakers. Ron Sider, who will be known to the older ones in the congregation from a book in the 1980s that he wrote called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, is also known as one of the founders of the Christian Peacemaker Trust. And he said this in 1984, addressing the Mennonite World Conference in North America. Unless comfortable North American and European Christians are prepared to risk injury and death in non-violent opposition to the injustices that our societies foster and assist, and unless we are prepared to pay the cost of peacemaking, we have no right to claim the label or preach the message of Christ. Fairly powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. And we prayed about Brexit not long ago, a few minutes ago. A friend said recently that she thinks that we're in the UK at the moment in the middle of a passive-aggressive civil war. And I thought that was a really good way of putting it. We are living in an intensely divided country, and I do not see any easy way forward. And if we think it's going to be simple, that we can somehow come together in unity, we are kidding ourselves. So peacemaking is our calling. Peacemaking is an opportunity. Forgiveness is part of that. How on earth do we go about it? We're going to read the Bible together. We're going to read Psalm 85 together. So if we could have the first bit up on the screen. Psalm 85 is an amazing psalm. It's a psalm that we could place in all sorts of places in Israel's history. It's a psalm that a people who are in trouble and distress can use to cry out to God for help. Any people, any group that are in distress can cry out to God for help using this psalm. And the psalm begins in these first three verses by looking back, which the Bible does so often. What are we going to do at Easter? We're going to look back. We're looking back at what Jesus did almost 2,000 years ago. In the Old Testament, Israel looked back to the Exodus, to when God delivered them. And here in this psalm, it starts by looking back at what God has done. When we're in trouble, when we're in difficulty, when things are not as they should be, we start by looking back. Let's read these verses out loud, verses 1 to 3. You, Lord, showed favor to your land. You restored the fortunes of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people and covered all their sins. You set aside all your wrath and turned from your fierce anger. Okay, so it begins by looking back to what God has done. And then it moves forward and says, Lord, will you do it again? Will you do again in our day what you have done so many times in the past? Let's read it. Restore us again, God our Saviour, and put away your displeasure towards us. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you prolong your anger through all generations? Will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your unfailing love, Lord, and grant us your salvation. And then the next few verses, if we could have those on the screen, are the response. And this is how it always works in the Bible. God doesn't act because we get it right. We don't have to get our house in order before God will intervene to save us. But because he intervenes to save us, a response is needed. It's a fundamental gospel principle. God takes the initiative, but then asks for a response. And so in this psalm, having cried out to God for deliverance, the psalmist then makes this promise. Let's read it. I will listen to what God the Lord says. He promises peace to his people, his faithful servants, but let them not turn to folly. Surely his salvation is near those who fear him, and his glory may dwell in our land. And then finally, the psalm finishes by looking ahead. It looks ahead to a better future. It looks ahead to a day when the mess that we're in will no longer be the case, but that God will have fixed things, certainly made things a whole lot better than they are now. It looks ahead to a better future. So let's read this. Love and faithfulness meet together. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. Faithfulness springs forth from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. The Lord will indeed give what is good, and our land will yield its harvest. Righteousness goes before him and prepares the way for his steps. Psalm 85 is a fascinating psalm because of how it's been used in peacemaking and reconciliation initiatives in our world in the last 20, 30 years. So the Norwegian diplomats who began the process of bringing peace in Israel-Palestine between the PLO and Israel in the 1990s started their meetings by reading this psalm. In South Africa in the late 1980s and early 90s, Africa Enterprise used this psalm in conversations between the ANC and the South African government. And the one that always amazes me and gets me the most is that the Roman Catholic priests who played a significant part in brokering the IRA ceasefire in 1995 read this psalm in the presence of the IRA. Places that we perhaps wouldn't expect this psalm to be read. And the reason for that is because of the work of a Mennonite called John Paul Lederach, who in the 1980s in Central America created reconciliation work and used this psalm. And you can see why, having read the psalm the way we did, that it's an intensely human psalm. Any people in a mess could read that psalm because it's a cry that things will be better. That we are in a mess and we want things to be better. And so it's not restricted to Christians, it's not restricted to Jews, it's in their scriptures after all. There's something intensely human about this psalm. It taps into something in any human situation where there's conflict, where there's fragmentation, where there's lack of forgiveness, where there's bitterness, where there's anguish. And says, Lord, if only things could be better. And the important verse is verse 10. And verse 10, which in the NIV has good sort of religious words like love and faithfulness meet together, righteousness and peace kiss together. In the Dwight Reams translation of the Bible, which is the Roman Catholic translation, has what I think are much more tangible, prosaic English language words. Truth and mercy have met, peace and justice have kissed. And because Lederach was working in Central America in the 1980s, he used the Spanish translation, the Dwight Reams version. This is the version, this is the language that was used. And you will see around the room, on the walls, if you've paid attention or noticed, that I've put these four words on pieces of paper. Truth, justice, mercy, and peace. And what Lederach said was, forgiveness, reconciliation, peace needs all of these. Now I'm going to say a little bit about that in a little while. But I'm going to stop and I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of work. And the first thing I'm going to do is to ask you to look at these four words and think about conflict, bitterness, a situation known to you. It might be one of the big ones. It might be Israel-Palestine. It might be Brexit. It might be a family situation. It might be your neighborhood. It might be a fight you're having with your neighbor. I mean, it's, you know, Jesus said we're to love our neighbours and love our enemies, and I think that's because they're often the same people. So think of a situation, and then think about which of these do you want to spend a bit of time thinking about the most? Because I'm going to ask you to, you're going to have to move. I know, I'm sorry. I mean, I know you've all got your reserved chairs and everything, and you all sit in the same seats all the time, but I'm going to ask you to think, okay, which of these in a conflict situation do I want to have a little bit of a chat about this morning for 10 minutes? Is it mercy and what mercy looks like? Is it justice? Is it truth? You know, they did this. That's why I'm angry. That's why I can't forgive them. Is it peace? I can't get any peace. We can't seem to be at peace. What's the thing you... Either you think it's really important and you'd like to talk about it a bit, or actually you don't understand it and you think it's a troublesome thing and you'd actually like to chat about it a bit. And I'm going to ask you to get up and move to the corner of the room. And so we're going to have to move out our chairs and move chairs around. Sorry, folks. I mean, I know it's, you know, you weren't expecting this morning. And I'm going to ask you in your group, and I think we can, you know, there's quite a few people here. So in some parts of the building, it might be two groups meet or three. You don't have to be, you know, you don't have to do it in one huge circle. It doesn't matter. But talk a bit about in conflict situations, in situations of bitterness and conflict, where forgiveness, where peace, where reconciliation is needed. Why is this important? Or what's the problem with it? Or what would it look like in practice? And you can think about, you can use it to describe a specific situation, you can talk about generally, I don't mind. But I've given you a little bit of a preamble now, I've given you a little bit of time. So if you would like to begin the process of getting out your seats and moving to the part of the room and shuffling chairs around, and we are going to spend only about 10 minutes, and then we'll take maybe one or two comments from each group, and I'll then do a little bit of feedback. Okay, off we go. Now, I'm aware that I could probably have just nipped out, gone to Costa, had a coffee, taken half an hour, come back, left you to it. It would have been quite a very straightforward, easy way of doing things. All we can do this morning is open up the topic. You can do this thing as a two-hour workshop, and there are dinners to be got to, so I'm not going to do that. But I'm just going to come round and sort of... perhaps ask each group just what you've been talking about so we can share a little bit. So come to the truth seekers first of all. Anyone from here care to share anything? You're gonna
go for it, be the bold one. I would say, well, I was looking around the room and I thought a lot of these things have been quite big in my life, mercy, peace and justice, but truth is quite a tricky one because I guess kind of seeking God's truth in my life rather than my own truth and knowing what is the essence of the word, like not just kind of thinking, okay, I'm going to speak truth and be true to my non-Christian friends that don't know Jesus. But I think a big thing that I was saying to these guys was asking God, tell me the truth, like whatever it is you want to say to me. Not saying, okay, God, tell me the truth until a certain point, and then that's enough. Okay, you've put me in a situation that I'm very uncomfortable with. I would say seeking God's truth when I don't know where it's going, when I'm walking down a path, and I'm walking in faith, and I just can't see where I'm going. Saying, okay, God, tell me the truth and know where I'm going and what you're saying. So...
thank you. Sorry, I'm going to have to keep these quite quick, sorry. But interesting point there about truth being uncomfortable. I think sometimes as Christians we talk a lot about, you know, believing truth, we think truth matters, but truth being quite an uncomfortable thing, quite an exposing thing maybe. What were you talking about in terms of truth, particularly in relation to conflict?
We were looking at, specifically conflict between individuals, where the situation was that people were looking for the truth, but when it comes down to it, it's fairly typical for one party to want to hide the truth. You know, when you talk about truth in a situation, it's like shining a light into the darkness to illuminate everything that's there. But often when people want to reconcile, one side still wants to hide the truth from the other.
And I wonder, actually, sometimes if we can even ever get to the truth. You ever tried to sort out two children who are arguing? Well, who did what? They did this. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. Well, you did that. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. You know, and we don't grow out of that. It's almost like that. So getting to truth is very difficult. And we have this aspiration for truth. What actually happened matters. But it's very hard to get to. And actually, I mean, and I go back to what you're saying, Phil, about, you know, that how much truth can you handle? You can't handle the truth, you know. It's who of us wants our browser history shared publicly? I mean, yeah, that, you know, but Jesus said the things that are done in secret will be shared from the rooftops. But we all want to keep things hidden because the things we've done wrong, do we want them shared? I don't. And yet in conflict, truth, we feel truth matters. I'm going to come to this group here and ask the merciful amongst you. they're the peaceful, but these are the merciful. So, and the justice warriors over here. Don't worry, I'm not going to leave you out. Who from this group would like to share a little bit about what you were talking about? Someone? Who were pointing to?
That's me, apparently. We were talking mostly about the duality of mercy and saying that it's very easy for one person to offer mercy, but that's not often reflected by other parties. For the point that I was making earlier on was about how it's an internal choice for us to come to that point where we give mercy, and that's more about what that says for us as opposed to anything that is received by others. We come to that point in any sort of conflict where we give mercy as a resolution for our own position in it, as opposed to anything that we want back from them. I think peace flows from that. I think we're saying it's all very closely intertwined. But for us, I think the notion is that mercy is something that flows from us first and foremost, and that reflects the mercy that God has shown us first.
Thank you, that's very helpful. That sort of decision to offer mercy regardless of whether it will be responded to. And it does very much fit into the Romans bit about while we were God's enemies, Christ died for us, doesn't it? He reached out regardless of whether we would respond. That's a costly thing to do, isn't it? To offer mercy or forgiveness. Because obviously there's a kind of deal, there's a transaction that's expected. The expectation is a response. And what if there isn't? Then you've exposed yourself. So you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable place to offer mercy. And yet, as has been pointed out, we have experienced that in God's relentless offer of mercy to us that never stops, regardless of our response. So thank you. That's really helpful. Okay, the folks that were interested in justice, what were you talking about?
So we were thinking about in conflict situations, they're very rarely black and white, and both sides in a conflict situation will have a sense that they are right, and therefore the idea that the other side might win would appear to them to be unjust, and that's a major stumbling block for them, for anybody to move from their position. And we also thought, well, for example, you know, and we went back to the childhood thing as well. Very often children, you hear children arguing, they'll say, it's not fair. And it's something that's instilled in us from a very, very young age. But when we talk about how do we reconcile and resolve conflicts, well, skilled negotiators will very often recognise that that both sides can't jump from one position to another position overnight. So very often what they will do is try to build trust by making small concessions on both sides so that the other side will see that they can trust the other side to make a change, and eventually get to a point where both sides can see that that justice has been served. They may not get everything that they want, but they will get to a point where they see that it's fair, and that's essentially what justice is. It's about fairness.
That's super summary, thank you. What about the other group of justice warriors? Anyone else want to add anything? Or, yeah.
We also looked at the fact that justice could likely be a barrier to any of the four aspects of the discussion actually coming through, and because justice needs to be defined as either restorative or, in some sense, where you get retribution, and you have to understand that in terms of your discussions to get to a point where the fairness and mercy, peace, etc. comes into play. It's interesting if our brothers and sisters from Iran would say in Iran that all four aspects of this discussion are at a very low ebb, and so they didn't find justice or peace or mercy there. And they see this country as a country that where these things are at a much higher level. We might argue against that, though, in this country, but we didn't get that far in the conversation.
That's very helpful. Different definitions of justice. That justice can be, I want my pound of flesh, I want retribution. Or there's, as you said, there's restorative justice. And there's another aspect of justice, which is about equality, fairness, as you said earlier, you know, which is about removing the source of the conflict in the first place. Because often conflicts come out of perceived injustices and real injustices. So it's not just about solving things, it's about preventing. Justice is important because it's preventative. And justice and fairness are really important in stopping things bubbling under and igniting again in the future. I'm aware our time is going, so I'll ask the peacemaker groups, the peaceful people here, to be fairly concise if you don't mind. But would someone from this group like to share something about peace?
Ours was actually interestingly quite similar to what other people were saying over there about truth, which was about often we can decide what peace looks like, even though we're seeking it, we've decided already what that peace can look like. And actually, a big part of peace is often like surrendering yourself. And we reflected on that alongside the piece of scripture that says that we have the ability to receive peace beyond our understanding. And often peace comes when you surrender yourself. And that can be, often be surrendering yourself from your own fixed ideas of what peace is.
Thank you. And
just very briefly, we were talking about how when you maybe haven't forgiven someone and you're finding it difficult to forgive someone, that it's very difficult to have any peace at all. But then when you are finally able to forgive, there's a huge relief that comes with that, the peace that follows forgiving someone.
Thank you all very much. I will, in very briefly, just give a few reflections and then hand back. Thank you for the work you did and for the thoughts that you've shared. The reason I like this approach partly because it's rooted in scripture, but as a way of thinking about healthy human relationships, the need for all four of these being kept in mind is quite a useful framework. And that all these things matter, particularly where things are tense. So truth does matter. You do need to establish who did what to who, as far as you can. As far as you can. The problem is truth on its own leaves people accused and vulnerable and judged. And so truth needs mercy, because mercy is the closest, if you like, to the forgiveness framework. It's about compassion. It allows the possibility of restored relationships, but on its own, it might just cover things over for the sake of a quiet life. So truth matters. Mercy needs truth, and truth needs mercy, because you have to know what's happened in order to forgive. But just knowing what's happened is not enough. And what was really important was that what the Croatian theologian Miroslav Volf calls the will to embrace the other person, even if they might reject you, doesn't stop you taking that step. And that hurts, and it's hurtful, and it's hard, but you still do it. And you still keep doing it. Justice is about restitution, but it's, as I've already said, it's about removing the sources of the conflict, trying to aim for equality, dealing with perceived injustices and inequalities. But on its own, it can lead to more injustice, as was already, more conflict. And in most conflict situations, in whatever level of disagreement we're talking about, most people are going to have to realize they're not going to get everything they want. But as long as, I mean, my sister and her husband are going through a pretty bitter divorce right now. And it's rather interesting talking to them, and particularly my sister, because my brother-in-law is kind of really angry chap now, saying, you're not going to get everything you want, because if you do, it's not going to end well. So trying to just sort of almost coach them through, coaching someone through a divorce is a rather interesting thing to do, but it's clearly game over, and therefore to me it's about doing this as well as possible. But ultimately peace is the end point. But funnily enough, maybe it's the starting point. You know, we talk about the peace process. It's almost like you start with, let's, you know, put the gun down, then we can talk. It's almost like let's agree to de-escalate things. Let's talk. Let's work out, as far as we can, what happened. Let's work out what justice is needed. Let's offer mercy so that ultimately peace is the end point. Justice could be the enemy of peace because the continued demand for justice could stir up more conflict. But ultimately, for the sake of peace, justice sometimes has to not be fully done. Mercy has to be offered in the light of the truth. The Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa was really interesting, wasn't it? People confessed to horrendous crimes and were allowed to get away with them. They were forgiven them. They did not suffer the justice they should have done because peace ultimately was the goal. And by and large, it worked. By and large, it worked. Peter Story was the president of the Methodist Church in South Africa and a member of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and he said this, and I will finish with this quote. Both the victim and the perpetrator must know pain if healing is to happen. It's an area that looks more like Calvary than the courtroom. It's a place where the guilty discover the pain of being forgiven because the innocent are willing to bear the greater pain of forgiving. The guilty discover the pain of being forgiven because the innocent are willing to bear the greater pain of forgiving. So this is, for me, forgiveness. It's a complex, difficult, ongoing, never settled reality. But the reason that I spent time with you this morning, the reason that I find this helpful, is it's rooted in Scripture and it gives us a framework to think about all our relationships, all human relationships, being characterized by truth, justice, mercy, and peace. And as we enter Holy Week, that's what we've been given by Jesus, and that's what he expects from us in our lives together.